The visual arts are filled with figures and episodes from the Hebrew Bible. Why were artists and patrons, Jewish and Christian, so interested in the Hebrew Bible? What encouraged them to use it as a wellspring of artistic themes and visual imagery? Could the artistic legacy of the Hebrew Bible help us understand aspects of the Hebrew Bible more richly, more deeply? These episodes revolve around profound moments of fulfillment through transformation. Artists recognized the Hebrew Bible as a means through which they could expand the vocabulary and expression of their medium. They reveal fundamental truths about the covenants between God and man, about the challenges we face as divinely created beings in a fraught human world, and about the struggles and evil we face to ensure our liberty and survival. Such was and is the power of art. Welcome back to the Artistic Legacy of the Hebrew Bible. I'm Jacob Weiss. We have, to this point, explored the artistic legacies of three episodes that come from the Pentateuch: the Binding of Isaac, Jacob wrestling with the angel, and Moses with the Ten Commandments. Our discussions have revealed different ways in which the artists took liberties with the character of these stories' original Hebrew biblical accounts, emphasizing, adding, or even altering details, sometimes dramatically or to dramatic effect. The paintings and sculptures we've looked at have all shared at least one overriding quality or goal. They aim to reinterpret, not illustrate, the subjects they depict. In the context of their synagogues, churches, manuscripts, or domestic interiors, these works of art reveal the potent relevancy that the Hebrew Bible had within their adopted contemporary worlds. They highlight the extent to which the Hebrew Bible was seen as a living tradition to which the creators of the works could contribute and from which they could derive meaning. In this discussion, we'll explore a biblical episode that comes from outside the five books of Moses, within the group of five scrolls, or Megillot, that form part of the Hebrew Bible known as the Writings, or Ketuvim. Two striking aspects of the episode of Queen Esther before King Ahasuerus, which comes from the book or scroll of Esther, Megillat Esther, worth noting: one, it is far from the most dramatic event in the Esther story, and two, the way artists represented this episode is very different from how the text describes it, carrying on the trend we've explored of a creative license or artistic reinvention. These two features are, no doubt, related and reveal something important about the nature of the artistic legacy of the Hebrew Bible. Before looking at the relatively brief passage that produced the extensive output of paintings and drawings of the subject, it's important to address several broader aspects of Esther that distinguish it from the books of Genesis and Exodus from which our prior episodes come. Although the book of Esther is a recognized part of the Hebrew Bible and, of course, forms the basis for the annual celebration of the Jewish holiday of Purim, it is unusual and stands out in the context of the biblical canon. It is the only scriptural text of which not a trace has been discovered among the Dead Sea Scrolls at Qumran. As Robert Alter has suggested, this absence may have had something to do with the very character of the book, which contains no references to God and describes a world that is fundamentally secular. Although Jews have come to recognize the role of benevolent, divine will in how the Purim story plays out, nothing in the text associates events with the influence, hand, or even presence of God. How different is this from the central textual place God has in the five books of Moses? Are scenes of Isaac's binding Jacob's wrestling match, and Moses' receiving of the Ten Commandments are but three of the innumerable episodes in which God, or a messenger of God, is not merely a presence in the framework of the story, but an actual character, guiding how events unfold and propelling the action forward. The author of Esther, its composition is believed to date to sometime in the late 5th century before the Common Era, was clearly aware of and sensitive to the literary structure and thematic nuances of the pre-existing core of the Hebrew Bible. Indeed, a number of narrative features of the Esther story reflect an awareness of, and perhaps a playing off of, biblical precedents. The parallel between Mordechai's eventual ascent to the powerful position of vice-regent of the kingdom and the story of Joseph in Egypt being one of the most frequently noted. But the basic vocabulary of the story and the world in which it's set are fundamentally different from the realm in which most of the Hebrew Bible takes place. The groundedness of the book of Esther has to do not only with the absence of divine intervention, or at least announced divine intervention, but also with the way it is marked by recognizable historical context. The story is firmly rooted within the world of the Persian Empire. Many of the imperial bureaucratic procedures and uses of written documents described in the text reflect the Persian system of governance. And the emphasis on luxurious dress, lavish banquets, and strict court etiquette correspond to the traditions of the Persian court. Several actual kings have been proposed as the basis or model for the identity of Ahasuerus, including, most commonly, Xerxes I, who reigned from 486 to 465 before the Common Era. Putting aside the specific merits of any one identification, Esther is set against an identifiable backdrop. Even though key plot points strain historical plausibility, and the action and characters of the text veer at points towards satire or even burlesque, the book tells a vividly and profoundly political story. The artistic legacy of the episode of Queen Esther before King Ahasuerus reflects this distinctly grounded character. Patrons and artists use the scene in ways that reveal political ideals and contemporary goals. Though its biblical provenance communicated a sense of higher purpose, the scene was manipulated to push calculated tactical agendas. Representations of Esther before Ahasuerus are based on a passage that appears at the very beginning of chapter 5, the very midpoint of the 10-chapter book. Indeed, Esther's uninvited appearance before the king to begin informing him of the genocidal plot that the king's evil royal vizier Haman is enacting against the Jews is the key pivot point in the story. When the plans Haman has been putting in place begin to unravel, and Mordechai's efforts and Esther's determination to foil the plans begin to yield results. Esther's appearance before the king, in effect to invite the king and Haman to a banquet at which she will reveal the plot exposing Haman, also marks a shift from Mordechai, Esther's uncle and guardian, driving the fight against Haman, to Esther taking the lead to reverse the decree and save the Jews. The verse that immediately precedes Esther's appearance before Ahasuerus, "And Mordechai moved on and did all that Esther had charged him," indicates this shift in leadership roles from uncle to niece. The key passage behind our episode reads, "And it happened on the third day that Esther donned royal garb and stood in the inner court of the king's house, opposite the king's house, with the king sitting on his royal throne in the royal house opposite the entrance to the house. And it happened, when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, that she found favor in his eyes, and he reached out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. And Esther approached and touched the top of the scepter, and the king said to her, 'What troubles you, Queen Esther, and what is your request?' up to half the kingdom, and it will be granted to you. And Esther said, if it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I have prepared for him. And the king said, hurry to Haman to do Esther's bidding. And the king and Haman came to the banquet that Esther had prepared. Looked at in strictly narrative terms, there's something downright anticlimactic about this scene. The buildup is considerable. We are told that a three-day fast of all of Shushan's Jews on Esther's behalf has preceded the meeting of Esther and Ahasuerus. At the conclusion of the previous chapter, Esther has declared, with a spirit of grim but stoic resolution, that she is willing to accept the dangerous consequences of appearing before the king unannounced. And so, I shall come to the king not according to rule, and if I perish, I perish. This follows Esther's earlier pronouncement that all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that every man and woman who come into the inner court without having been called, the single rule is to put to death unless the king reach out to him the golden scepter. And as for me, I have not been called to come to the king 30 days now. And so, the danger Esther faces and her recognition of the danger she faces are fully present. When the time finally comes for the meeting, the reader is still held in check. The narrator meticulously orients the characters before they even come face to face. Esther stands in the inner court of the king's house, opposite the king's house, while the king sits on his throne in the royal house, opposite the entrance to the house. We are meant to understand that as Esther approaches the inner court, she and the king can see each other. The anticipation is somewhat over the top, no? And for what? When Esther is finally in the audience of the king and a request is elicited, she does not touch on the matter of the genocidal plot brewing in the king's midst, but invites the king and Haman to dinner. In the feast-centered context of the Persian court, this will only be the first banquet to which Haman and the king will be invited. Not until two chapters later will a second banquet follow, at which Esther finally reveals the nature of the conspiracy and the identity of the person at its heart. Sensitive to the staged unfolding of Esther's appearance before Ahasuerus, Jewish commentators had a proverbial field day with the background to this scene, reading considerable drama into Esther's motivations and the basis for her apprehension. One line of interpretation follows the Talmudic tradition according to which Esther was not Mordechai's niece, but his wife. Her apprehension then was caused by an awareness that in willfully going before the king and an intimate sexual interaction is at least intimated here, she would be committing a grave transgression and even lose the possibility of returning to her husband Mordechai. Midrashic literature also inserts divine inspiration into the unfolding drama. In one commentary, Esther's resolve to meet with the king is bolstered by the divine spirit, while it subsequently leaves her, leading her to pray to God for wisdom and to have her strength restored. According to Midrash, Esther is ultimately supported, physically and spiritually, while she is before Ahasuerus by divine messengers. And the Midrash reads, Rabbi Yochanan said, three ministering angels happened to join her at that time, one that raised up her neck so that she could stand erect, free of shame, one that strung a cord of divine grace around her, endowing her with charm and beauty, and one that stretched the king's scepter. And so, while God is not explicitly mentioned in the Book of Esther, rabbinic tradition expends considerable energy framing for us the means through which God is very much present, in between the lines, as it were, in this episode and in the story overall. Like the larger goal of declaring the nature of the Purim miracle through the public reading of the Megillah, divine guidance was attributed to Esther as a means to explain her heroic determination and to give thanks for the sympathetic ways her actions were received. Since the Talmudic period, it's been customary to write the Book of Esther on parchment in the form of a scroll. But although the rules governing the production and writing are similar to those of a traditional Torah scroll, at least in part because Esther does not explicitly mention God, a tradition emerged, one Jewish religious law accepts, for Esther scrolls to be illustrated alongside the text. The earliest existing illuminated scrolls come from 16th century Italy. The practice of decorating scrolls reached its peak in the 17th and 18th centuries in Italy, the Netherlands, where this scroll comes from, and other European countries, but spread to North Africa and Middle Eastern communities as well. The heightened demand for illustrated scrolls led to the production of engraved scrolls printed from copper plates, which could be reproduced more efficiently and less expensively. While the text was still copied by hand, as required by Jewish law, engraved images on Esther scrolls became quite common. The image of Esther before Ahasuerus is one of among many images that decorate illuminated or engraved scrolls which feature episodes sequentially, one after the other, the scenes typically situated in the border corresponding roughly to where the passages appear below or above in the text. This scene, from an early 17th century scroll that was written and illuminated by hand in Ferrara, Italy, reflects a standard composition. It features Esther kneeling, an elongated collar and regal dress evoking her majestic appearance and recognized status before the throned figure of the king, with the king extending the golden scepter to Esther, who is touching the top of it. Very little extraneous background or detail is indicated. The image focuses primarily on the figures. In scrolls with printed images, similarly oriented images of Esther before Ahasuerus appear, but they are often set within elaborate architectural settings or against urban backdrops that evoke the contemporary settings of the place where the scroll was produced. The elaborate engraved borders of this scroll in the collection of the Jewish Museum in New York are the work of the Jewish artist Salom Italia, who was born into a family of printers in Milan, but eventually settled in Amsterdam after being forced to flee Italy. 17th century Amsterdam, which became home to Rembrandt and other artists of the Dutch Golden Age, had a prospering community of Jews who enjoyed a state of relative religious freedom. This scroll was printed from one engraving plate consisting of four arches, which was repeated five times to produce a large arcade as a frame for the text. The artist here integrated standing figures from the Purim story flanking the text. He oriented the figures towards each other across the text, here King Ahasuerus at right, facing Queen Esther at left, suggesting the encounter between them from the narrative. One of Italia's great innovations to the design of this and other Esther scrolls was setting the text within portals derived from triumphal arches. The practice of conducting triumphal processions through arches dates back to ancient Rome, and the building of temporary arches to honor rulers as they entered a city continued in Europe until the 19th century. The original owners of this scroll would have understood the reference to triumphal entries in this decorative program. Amsterdam mounted a magnificent triumphal entry for the stadtholder or chief magistrate of the Netherlands shortly after Italia's arrival in Amsterdam. As Jewish tradition encourages, they would have recognized and appreciated the potential connections of Esther's actions from the Purim story to their own historical situation and context. By the 15th century in Italy, the story of Esther became part of the repertoire of artists working outside of the ceremonial context of scroll decoration. One of the ways it entered into the mainstream, that is, non-Jewish culture, was through its association with wedding celebrations. Because the story revolves around the marriage of Ahasuerus and Esther, whose great wedding banquet is celebrated with the granting of tax relief for the provinces of Shushan and the bestowing of gifts in kingly fashion, painted scenes from the Book of Esther were introduced onto kasoni, wedding chests that were presented to the bride to be placed in the bridal chamber. Often framed by stucco borders decorated with gold leaf, kasoni chests made use of subjects frequently drawn from mythological or biblical sources, ones that evoked both lavish celebration and that conveyed uplifting or moralizing allegorical meanings related to love and marriage. Scenes from Esther commonly appear as subjects on the side panels of chests produced in Florence, the center of kasoni production during the Renaissance. In this detailed representation of the story of Esther, produced by a prestigious Florentine workshop in the 1460s, the painter transposed the setting to the streets of contemporary Florence, marked by the facades of a Renaissance palace and late Gothic church, and a view into a loggia, a private portico, where the wedding feast and celebration take place. This painting of Esther before Ahasuerus was one of the four paintings based on the Book of Esther that decorated a kasoni produced in Florence a little later in the 15th century. Like the other three scenes, all painted by Jacopo del Salaio, an artist who specialized in painting wedding chests, this one highlights the trappings of the royal setting. It gives prominence to the throne room where the meeting between Esther and the king takes place, decorated with a gold-embroidered cloth of honor, and to the adjacent Renaissance courtyard. Within contemporary Florence, which was characterized by strict rules of ceremony and comportment, Esther served not only as a model of courage for saving her people, but also as an exemplum of conjugal virtue, that is, the importance of making and maintaining a good marriage. Another scene that appeared on the same kasoni depicting the banquet of Queen Vashti served as a cautionary tale of the disobedient wife. The painting illustrates at right the banquet organized by Queen Vashti for the women of the palace. Kneeling before her are the eunuchs sent by her husband to show her beauty to the peoples and the ministers, what many have understood as a call to parade herself naked. Vashti refuses, leading Ahasuerus to repudiate her, strip her of her crown, and send her away from the palace, the scene that is playing out at left. In Renaissance society, Vashti was used as an example of an inappropriately proud and disobedient wife, whose behavior was the cause of her disgrace and downfall. The complimentary scene set Esther's virtue into even sharper relief. And it's worth taking note here of how dramatically Vashti's standing has changed in contemporary society. A recent article from a Jewish newspaper titled, "Queen Esther is a Jewish Hero, but Queen Vashti is the Feminist Icon We Need Right Now," tells you all you need to know to chart how much her star has risen. In a perhaps complimentary reversal of fortune, how different is the cautionary ways early Talmudic and Midrashic sources consider the marital status and behavior of Esther from the paragon of marital virtue that she is seen to represent within the non-Jewish world during the Renaissance era? In broader terms, Vashti and Esther came to represent within medieval Christian exegesis two contrasting ideals and traditions. Vashti was associated with synagoga, or the synagogue, a symbol of Judaism, the old faith that would be superseded. Like Vashti, synagoga disobeyed rightful authority, refusing the teachings of the apostles, and like Vashti, synagoga was discharged from its place of dominion, being dismissed by God. Esther came to represent ecclesia, or the church. Like Esther, ecclesia intercedes dutifully on behalf of her people and is recognized as the rightful queen. Such allegorical associations were incorporated into paintings and sculptures during the Renaissance. The Venetian artist Paolo Veronese, for instance, contrasted side by side the figures of the two women in an Esther cycle painted in the 1550s on the Church of St. Sebastian in Venice. In the oval-shaped scene on the left, Veronese depicts the moment of repudiation with Vashti, relieved of her crown, descending the staircase of the royal palace with her retinue. In the painting at right, Esther, facing in the opposite direction as Vashti, kneels on a marble staircase as Ahasuerus places a crown on her head. She is attended by two young women who represent chastity and humility. The cycle is completed with a third painting featuring the figures of Mordechai and Haman, which allegorically depicts the ultimate triumph of the church. Transformations in the way Esther was seen in relation to the social institution of marriage were not the only changes that visual representations of the Esther story wielded on the narrative account in the Megillah and its early interpretive tradition. A painted version of Esther before Ahasuerus from another late 15th century Florentine Cassone, now in the Louvre Museum in Paris, depicts the episode in a very different way. In this wide rectangular panel, which decorated one of the two long sides of the marriage chest, several distinct scenes are depicted side by side, as if in sequence. At the left is the depiction of Mordechai lamenting, which corresponds to the beginning of chapter 4 in the book of Esther, when upon learning about Haman's plot and the extent to which it has been set in motion, he appears before the palace gate in garments that he has torn and a sackcloth that he dons in mourning. At the right of the panel is the depiction of Haman begging for mercy from Esther, with Haman being hung in the background. The central scene and the largest part of the panel is devoted to a depiction of Esther before Ahasuerus, but it represents the scene in a fundamentally different way from how the story is told in the Book of Esther and from the depictions we have already looked at. In this painting, Esther, her head virtually hidden, is seen in hunched profile, leaning on the head and shoulder of one of her two female attendants, while the other attendant desperately reaches around Esther's body from the back in order to support her. Meanwhile, the king, enthroned before a cloth of honor, extends his scepter somewhat ineffectually towards the group of women, while courtiers to his left and right react with varying degrees of concern, shock, or confusion. This is, in fact, a depiction of Esther fainting before Ahasuerus, the same part of the Esther story, but filtered through a later repackaging of the narrative, Esther Rabbah, also known as Midrash Ahasuerus or Midrash Megillah. This Midrash on the Book of Esther consists of two distinct parts. The first, compiled around the 6th century, provides verse-by-verse interpretations. The second, compiled around the 11th century, retells and expands upon the Esther story. The two parts were probably combined into one work around the 12th or 13th century. It was one of a number of later adaptations and apocryphal accounts through which the story of Esther was expanded upon and elaborated. How does Esther Rabbah characterize the appearance of Esther before Ahasuerus? This is how the Midrashic tale unfolds. She took her two young women with her. She placed her right hand on one young woman and leaned on her in accordance with the royal custom, and the second young woman walked behind her mistress, supporting her jewels, so that the gold would not touch the ground. She put on a joyful face, masked the worry in her heart, and came to the inner courtyard facing the king, and she stood before him. The king was sitting on his royal throne in garments of gold and jewels. He lifted his eyes and saw Esther standing before him, and his wrath was greatly inflamed because she had violated his protocol, and she came before him without being summoned. Esther lifted her eyes and saw the king's face, and his eyes were like fire, blazing from the great fury in his heart. Esther recognized the king's anger, and she was greatly panicked, and her spirit grew faint. She placed her head on the young woman supporting her on the right. Our God saw and took pity on his people, recognized the suffering of the orphan who had placed her trust in him, invested her with grace before the king, and added beauty to her beauty and magnificence to her magnificence. The king rose from his throne in a frenzy, ran to Esther, hugged and kissed her, and placed his arm around her neck. The king said to her, "Queen Esther, why are you afraid? This protocol that we instituted is not incumbent upon you, as you are my beloved and my companion." He said to her, "Why, when I saw you, did you not speak to me?" Esther said, "My lord, the king, when I saw you, my soul was startled due to your greatness." The author of Esther Rabbah gives fervent voice to two motifs embedded in the Talmudic and Midrashic interpretations discussed earlier. One is the danger Esther faced in appearing unannounced before the king and the terror it would have elicited in her. And two is the way God, here explicitly incorporated into the story, is seen as strengthening the heroine Esther in her time of need and making conditions favorable for her mission to succeed. The artists of the Louvre panel deftly dramatized the episode, the action still unfolding and the result of Esther's appearance before Ahasuerus still in limbo. They represent the very moment Esther loses strength upon recognizing the king's anger and seeks the physical support of her attendants. God has not yet intervened and the story has not yet turned. The overall design of this composition is usually credited to the great Florentine master Sandro Botticelli, while most of the actual execution is credited to Filippino Lippi, a slightly younger artist who trained in Botticelli's workshop. In their skillful hands and through their conception, we are invited to behold not only the narrative elaboration of the episode of Esther before Ahasuerus, but also its vividly dramatized representation. Bracketed by the prelude of Mordechai's lament for the fate of the Jews, and the aftermath of Haman's unsuccessful plea for mercy and his execution, the scene of Esther before Ahasuerus highlights this key point in the story that changed the course of events. We are not sure for whom the marriage chest that this panel belonged to was intended. Some believe that it was commissioned by a Jewish family in Florence. Others that it was made for a marriage between two non-Jewish noble families. Whatever the case, Cassoni and similar panels were commissioned by wealthy Jewish patrons. The subject of Esther before Ahasuerus, among other Hebrew biblical scenes, formed one of the key subjects in their repertoire. Like the Hebrew biblical figures of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Moses discussed in our earlier sessions, Esther was adopted by Christianity as a typological figure to undergird the narrative and principles of the faith. Christian theologians regarded Esther as a precursor to the Virgin Mary. Both were seen as intercessors who, by acting courageously and heroically against the will of antagonistic political and cultural forces, saved their people from destruction. Mary, with Joseph, took the infant Jesus to Egypt, saving him from death as a result of Herod's order to kill all the boys in Bethlehem, thus preserving the foundation of the Christian faith, a presumed parallel to Esther's actions to save the Jewish people. In theological terms, the exception that was granted to Esther when she broke the unyielding rules of Persian law and appeared uninvited before the king was read as a precedent for Mary's immaculate conception, that is, the belief that Mary was uniquely pure and free from sin at the moment she conceived Jesus. The basis for this perceived parallel between Esther and Mary was strengthened, or fueled in part, by additions that were made to the Book of Esther that appeared in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible. Called the rest of the chapters of the Book of Esther, which are found neither in the Hebrew nor in the Chaldee, yes, it is a mouthful, or Rest of Esther for short, this book is regarded as canonical by the Catholic Church, though it is considered apocryphal by the Protestant Church. Distinct from the original text of Esther in the Hebrew Bible, in both its structure and its content, the Septuagint's account of the Esther story, and specifically of Esther's appearance before Ahasuerus, closely follows the Midrashic account from Esther Rabbah. It reads, "And it happened on the third day, as Esther ceased praying, she took off the garments of service and put on the garments of glory. Then, when she had become majestic, and after calling upon the All-Knowing One and Savior God, she took along with her two attendants, and on one she leaned gently for support, while the other followed, holding up her train. She was radiant with the full flush of her beauty, and her face looked as if she were cheerful, but her heart was in anguish. When she had gone through the doors, she stood before the king, and the king was seated on the throne of his kingdom, clothed in the full array of splendor, all covered with gold and precious stones upon him. And he was most terrifying. And when he raised his face, inflamed with glory, he gazed right at her like a bull in the full flush of his anger. The queen was terrified, and her face turned pale from faintness, and she stooped on the head of the attendant who went before her. Then God changed the spirit of the king and turned his anger to gentleness, and alarmed, the king jumped down from his throne and took her in his arms. He comforted her and said, 'What is it, Esther? I am your brother. Take heart. You shall not die, for our act is only for the common person. The threat is not against you. Look, the scepter is in your hand.' Then he lifted the scepter and placed it on her neck. He welcomed her and said, 'Speak to me.' She said to him, 'I saw you like a divine angel, and my heart melted from the glory of your rage, Lord.' And upon her face was a measure of sweat. Then the king and all his servants were troubled, and they reassured her." In this account, God is introduced earlier in the episode than in the Midrashic account. Esther calls on the All-Knowing One before entering to see the king. The composers of the rest of Esther and the theologians that made use of it to advance a Christian view read the Esther story as an unfolding of preordained, divinely inspired events. Artists played an especially important role in engagingly representing this Christian view of the Esther story and in dynamically expressing and driving home the parallels between Esther and Mary. One of the earliest paintings that closely follows the Septuagint's account of the story is by Jacopo Robusti, commonly known as Tintoretto, one of a number of late Renaissance and Baroque artists from Venice who depicted the subject of Esther before Ahasuerus. In Tintoretto's painting, the king and Esther, surrounded by a multitude of elaborately dressed figures, are brought up close to the picture plane, making the viewer experience the drama of the event in a more immediate, palpable way. Strikingly, Tintoretto's Esther has completely fainted from her encounter with Ahasuerus. She has collapsed quite literally in a heap, with her two female attendants and several others from those gathered around her, trying desperately to support her limp form. It seems the artist has envisioned a moment just beyond when the queen went faint. Indeed, Esther's complexion is quite pale, made glaringly manifest through the bold contrast between her white skin tone and the rich, saturated colors of the carpet, the architectural backdrop, and the people and garments around her, including Esther's own peachy pink gown. Esther's arms are extended noticeably outward from each of her sides. Her right arm has drooped completely to the ground, her hand resting on the lowest carpeted step to the king's throne. Esther's unconscious state is set off by the liveliness of the figures around her. From those attempting to assist Esther or beseeching others to assist her, to those craning over others to get a better view of what's transpired, to the urgent figure of the king who seems, in a vivid echo of the Greek text, alarmed, and in the midst of jumping down from his throne to take Esther in his arms. Tintoretto, whose speed of painting, dynamic brushwork, bold use of perspective, rich color palette, and energetic gestures helped earn him the nickname Il Furioso, the Furious One, applies his skills to great effect in evoking the dramatic upheaval of the throne room encounter. Why would Tintoretto have depicted Esther in this way? That is, outright fainted, beyond the liminal state of faintness in which she is described in the apocryphal text. Tintoretto's Esther does not just lean on the attendant for support, she is out cold. The inspiration for the intensification of Esther's condition is the artist's goal of creating an echo for the Virgin Mary, who was commonly depicted as swooning at the foot of the cross in depictions of Jesus' crucifixion, thus deepening the thematic parallel between the two figures. The motif of what was called the swooning virgin was itself derived from apocryphal accounts and became popular in late medieval art and theological literature. Imagining or envisioning that Mary fainted at the sight of her son being taken to die, being crucified, or being taken down from the cross reflected the natural emotional anguish that she experienced. Late medieval and Renaissance culture nurtured this idea of humanizing holy figures, making them supreme models of our own religious experiences. But the swooning virgin also had deeper theological implications, suggesting the physical and, by extension, the spiritual identification between Mary and Jesus at the moment of his sacrifice. This idea is reflected in an altarpiece of the Deposition, or the Descent from the Cross, painted by the great early Netherlandish artist Rogier van der Weyden in the 1430s for the Greater Guild of Crossbowmen of Leuven, an important university town in present-day Belgium, about 20 miles east of Brussels. Mary is shown completely unconscious at the foot of the cross, held up by John the Evangelist and Mary Salome, the Virgin Mary's half-sister. Like Esther in Tintoretto's painting, Mary is bloodlessly, lifelessly pale, suggesting a state that is meant to be associated with that of her son, who is being lowered from the cross following the crucifixion. Van der Weyden heightened the sense of identification between the two figures by orienting Mary's limp body in a remarkably close echo of Jesus' position. Through this physical parallel, members of the Archers Guild, who commissioned and beheld this painting in the context of their chapel, would have been encouraged to regard Mary as participating in, that is, as a co-redemptrix, in the redemptive role that Jesus is understood to have had through his martyrdom. Many see in van der Weyden's composition reflections of the ideas put forward by 15th century Catholic mystics and theologians like Thomas a Kempis, who encourage readers to personally identify with the suffering of Jesus and Mary, and Denis the Carthusian, who emphasized the significance of Mary's near-death experience at the moment of Jesus' crucifixion. Mary's swoon also came to be represented in depictions of Jesus carrying the cross and the lamentation over Jesus, but was especially common in crucifixions, one art historian estimating that about half of the surviving paintings of the crucifixion, painted between 1300 and 1500, include the motif of Mary fainting. Tintoretto's painting of Esther before Ahasuerus firmly links Esther to the Virgin Mary, reinforcing the typological association of the Hebrew biblical heroine with the Christian mother of the church. Extrapolating from the context of Christian art and doctrine, viewers would be expected to recognize Mary's presence and her identity in Esther's struggle and sacrifice for the redemption of her people. But not all church authorities approved of such a characterization of the heroine. Since no incident of Mary fainting is mentioned in the four canonical Gospels, many theologians rejected the idea that she be depicted in this way. This backlash was fueled by the assertion that showing Mary swooning or exhibiting physical weakness as a result of emotional exertion and distress disagreed with the way Mary is originally characterized. In the Gospel of St. John, for instance, Mary is described as exhibiting great strength and endurance as she stands beside the cross. Others characterized a loss of consciousness, however momentary, as being incompatible with the presence and fullness of mind that allows Mary to suffer and bear up as she did. The Church expressed a kind of official disapproval of the swoon during the Counter-Reformation, and through the guidelines set in place at the Council of Trent in the 1550s and 1560s, artists were discouraged from including any such imagery that would go against canonical doctrine or promote signs of spiritual weakness. It's striking to note in this regard that a version of Esther before Ahasuerus painted by Tintoretto in the decade following his previously discussed work, this one from the 1550s, depicts Esther in a very different fashion. Here, with one of her attendants holding the train of an elaborate golden gown, she kneels in full ownership of her faculties. She has one hand over her chest in gracious recognition of the honor the king gives her in extending to her his scepter. Could the nature and spirit of this depiction have been influenced by the disapproval artists faced over representing Mary and, by extension, Esther in a weakened or compromised state? We know that in the wake of the Counter-Reformation, there was some actual censorship, especially in Rome and to some extent in Venice, with offending works of art being removed from public view. For the most part, the church worked to discourage artists from painting in ways it saw as running counter to doctrine, sometimes bringing them before the Inquisition to face charges of heresy. Might Tintoretto's second version of Esther before Ahasuerus been a result of the church's push towards Orthodox iconography? But the church picked its battles, and when it came to art, only the most important theological subjects were overseen with a more rigorous, censorious hand. Depictions of subjects other than crucifixions, for instance, were often handled much more leniently. It's also the case that artists did not always follow the strictest rules. As merely a quick comparison between Tintoretto's earlier and later depictions of Esther before Ahasuerus suggests, a fainting Esther may provide for a more engagingly dramatic subject matter than a graciously stalwart Esther, and artists, patrons, and the viewing public of the late Renaissance and Baroque eras especially appreciated dramatic subjects. And so, just as a swooning or fainting Mary persisted well into the 17th century, so too did a similarly unsteady or outright unconscious Esther, perhaps reflecting how fraught the characterization of Esther was. Artists often seemed to navigate a kind of semi-conscious middle ground. Paolo Veronese, who himself was brought before a tribunal in the wake of the Council of Trent over the church's objections to a monumental Last Supper deemed heretical that Veronese had painted for a local monastery, depicted the subject of Esther before Ahasuerus multiple times. In this version, now in the Louvre, Esther stands before the king in a throne room that is modeled following the custom of Veronese and his proud Venetian contemporaries after the style of the city's own grand architecture. Ahasuerus looking imperious. He has not yet extended his scepter towards Esther. It still rests in the crook of his left arm, sits on a raised throne decorated with golden damask textiles and marble inlay. Esther, tightly framed by her two female attendants, is unsteady and appears to exhibit a combination of fear and a loss of will. The attitude of her two attendants suggests concern. The figure at right is supporting Esther's left arm. The figure at left is clutching Esther's brocaded gown while supporting Esther's head with her own. The artist faithfully depicts the moment when, according to the apocryphal Rest of Esther, the king raised his face inflamed with glory. He gazed right at her like a bull in the full flush of his anger. The queen was terrified, and her face turned pale from faintness, and she stooped on the head of the attendant who went before her. Veronese suggests a suspenseful midway point in Esther's intercession, just before God changed the spirit of the king and turned his anger to gentleness. A more faintly painted passage in the background of the composition, visible immediately above the queen but depicting an event that occurs at another time of the story, could refer to Mordecai's earlier beseeching of Esther to intervene on behalf of the Jews, or to Haman's subsequent pleading in vain for mercy from Esther. Thus, Veronese gently suggests how this tense set piece is propelled from a darker beginning or advances towards a righteous conclusion. Artists of the Baroque era embraced the full-on swoon or the total faint, often focusing more closely on the dynamics between Esther and Ahasuerus at the expense of the broader court context. Artemisia Gentileschi, the most famous female painter of the 17th century, often depicted episodes drawn from the Hebrew Bible, among them, a number of them, with women as central parts of the story. This work seems to have been influenced by the Veronese work we just discussed, a painting the artist could have seen when she resided in Venice in the 1620s. The arrangement of Esther and her two attendants and the orientation of their heads and hands seems closely related to Veronese's conception. But in Gentileschi's work, Esther is no longer on the verge of fainting. Her head is inclined acutely in the opposite direction of her body and her eyes completely closed. In complement to Esther's heightened state of exertion, the artist has eliminated all extraneous figures from the composition, leaving a dark open area between her and the figure of the king, who supports himself on the arms of his throne and moves his left leg out towards Esther, as if in the midst of rising to comfort her. Indeed, as revealed in an X-ray made of the canvas, the artist initially painted the figure of an African page restraining a dog in between Esther and Ahasuerus, but subsequently painted the boy and dog out, highlighting the dramatic interplay between the king and queen, and giving greater vibrancy to the composition through the stark contrast of areas of light and dark. In light of Gentileschi's ongoing interest in the character of Hebrew biblical heroines and of what we know of an informal literary academy at which the nature of women and the differences between women and men were discussed, discussions, in fact, the artist could have participated in while she was at work on the painting, it's likely this work was intended to animate the differences in character between Esther and Ahasuerus. Although the narrative details of this depiction closely follow the episode as it is retold in the apocryphal Rest of Esther, might the artist here also be taking inspiration from the satirical, parodic origins of the original Book of Esther? Much of the painting seems theatrically dramatized, from the exaggerated pose of Esther to the comically dandyish bearing and outfit of the king, including an extravagantly feathered hat and crown, slashed sleeves, and fur-trimmed jeweled boots. We might wonder, is Gentileschi's Esther really fainting? As one critic has characterized the figure, she is represented as swooning in a totally calculated manner, her eyes momentarily closed for effect, more theater than emotional crisis, and thoroughly designed to manipulate the foppish king before her. It is Esther at her most powerful. Within the context of dramatically engaging early Baroque visual culture, and with remarkable technical and conceptual skills at her disposal, Gentileschi provides us with a vivid demonstration of the ways the original Esther story could inspire artistic reinvention or be redirected in artistic form. But perhaps the most vivid demonstration of how dramatically the original intent of the Book of Esther and the spirit of the holiday of Purim, which follows from it, could be turned on its head is a painting by an almost exact contemporary of Gentileschi, Giovanni Francesca Barbieri, commonly known as Guercino. Guercino was active for most of his career in Rome and Bologna, but executed this version of Esther before Ahasuerus for an ecclesiastical patron in Ferrara, which, in the wake of a powerful earthquake that struck the city at the end of the 16th century, lost much of its economic vigor and became part of the papal states for the following three centuries under the direct sovereign rule of the Pope. The painting was commissioned by Cardinal Lorenzo Magalotti, a relative of Pope Urban VIII, who served as Bishop of Ferrara from 1628 until his death in 1637. Although continuing the trend of following the Catholic Church's official canonical account of Esther's appearance before Ahasuerus, as told in the Rest of Esther, this depiction was guided by the specific theological beliefs and mission of the patron, who was a staunch supporter of the church's efforts to stamp out heresy in its territories. Magalotti, as it turns out, was also not a big fan of Jews, of whom he wrote, "I swear to take bitter vengeance upon the heathen mob of the reckless Hebrews, to disturb the godless and haughty progeny who conspire as if to kill me." Among the challenges Magalotti faced upon assuming the bishopric of Ferrara was to maintain and enforce the separation of Christians and Jews, who were sequestered in a ghetto that was inaugurated the year before he arrived in the city. The bishop instituted new laws and strengthened existing ones intended to keep the two communities apart, to punish Jews for breaking ranks, and to abolish the public practice of Judaism. In compliments to these measures, the bishop also spoke of the goal to convert Jews to Christianity, stripping them, as he wrote in one document, of their perfidious beliefs, and yet to do so with gentleness and clemency. As the art historian Shelley Perlov has convincingly argued, Guercino's painting of Esther before Ahasuerus was intended to give expression and pay tribute to the bishop's efforts to defend the faith and bring Jews into the Christian fold. Guercino evokes the traditional association of Esther with the Virgin Mary, embroidering Esther's cloak with pomegranates, used as a Christian symbol of immortality, charity, and the merits of the Virgin Mary. By dressing Esther in this garment, Guercino figuratively transforms her into the figure of Mary, symbol of the church through which the faithful are understood to achieve salvation. It's also possible that Esther's facial features were modeled specifically on those of a famous local convert from Judaism, Lucretia Senesi, who became quite well known for her public statements against Jews, and who Guercino may have met when he visited Ferrara in the mid-1620s. Deepening the contemporary political resonance of the work, the figure of Achashverosh was likely intended to evoke the bishop himself. The brilliant red of the king's garment is reminiscent of the cardinal's robe worn by Magalotti, and the rosettes carved into the arm of the throne are the same motifs that appear in the bishop's family crest. Guercino seems to have generated a contemporary allegory of the bishop's mission, dressed up in the guise of the episode of Esther before Achashverosh. Looked at as a whole, it's striking how intimate the composition of the work is, especially compared to the grand courtly settings that mark many of the earlier works we've looked at. The figures of the king and queen are brought up close to the picture plane and close to each other. Their hands seem almost to touch. Achashverosh gestures, meanwhile, not only with his right hand, which extends the scepter towards Esther, but also with his left hand, which is drawn delicately back towards his chest. His bearing suggests magnanimity, kindness, and acceptance, virtues the bishop publicly celebrated in his mission to proselytize the Jews. One can't help but be struck by the monumental irony, although I'm not quite sure irony fully captures it, that is conveyed through Guercino's transformation of the episode of Esther before Achashverosh into a contemporary allegory of Christian conversion. The Book of Esther, after all, tells the story of the overturning of a nefarious plot to kill the Jews and ends with a call never to forget such threats and to preserve the continuity of Jewish communal life. But perhaps one can see in Guercino's painting something of the original spirit of the Esther text, whose key, it has often been noted, is reversal. Instead of Haman's minions killing the Jews, it is the Jews who kill them. Instead of Haman serving as vice regent, it is Mordechai who attains the role at the end of the book. And so on, with many more such reversals in between. This theme is actually spelled out in the first verse of chapter 9, with the Hebrew words, v'yahafochu, literally, on the contrary, or it was the opposite. One can see it as a reflection of the importance of historical context and of the unyielding power of the Book of Esther that Guercino's take on the episode could so dramatically reverse the narrative. Interest among artists in Esther's encounter with Achashverosh continued, as did the dynamic way the episode was adapted for dramatically different political, cultural, and religious goals. In the Protestant territories of the Netherlands, the story elicited distinct associations. As we've noted, in theological terms, the Protestant Church did not accept the authority of the rest of Esther, considering it apocryphal. As a result, many of the depictions painted in the 17th century by artists working in the Netherlands hew much more closely to the basic character of the original text. The Protestant Church also rejected the notion of a swooning or fainting Virgin Mary, a motif that was evoked in the Septuagint's account of Esther before the king. As a result, depictions of Esther swooning were avoided, downplayed, or characterized in less dramatic fashion. One of the many Dutch renditions of the subject was painted by Jan van Steveren, an artist based in Leiden and associated with the Feinschilders, literally, the fine painters. Their work, usually painted in oil on small panels, was characterized by meticulous detail and clearly delineated forms. In van Staveren's depiction, Esther kneels before Achashverosh, who holds the scepter towards her as she reaches to touch it. Surrounded by exotically dressed figures and framed on three sides by an elaborately twisted red curtain, The composition suggests a set piece from the theater. Indeed, there were several popular Dutch plays devoted to the story of Esther, with which the artist was surely familiar. The large number of Dutch plays devoted to the story of Esther stems from the parallels the Dutch saw between Esther's triumph over Haman and their own struggle against the Kingdom of Spain in the 80 Years' War, which ended in the recognition of an independent Dutch Republic in 1648. The link between Esther's heroism and the Dutch fight for independence reflected the deep Protestant absorption of the culture of the Hebrew Bible. It was bolstered by the role of divine providence that the Dutch recognized as being central to Esther and to the Jews' victory over a more powerful enemy. This connection would have appealed to the patron or first owner of Van Staveren's painting, as it did to the patrons and owners of other Esther-themed works and theatrical productions. Another Dutch painting of the subject from about 20 years later, this one by Jan Steen, also from Leiden, makes use of a similar compositional structure, including the curtain, although here it is blue. Although Esther is represented listing, as if on the verge of fainting, Steen's painting is otherwise filled with a similar array of theatrically conceived characters who display a variety of reactions to the meeting of Esther with the king. Among the figures given prominence is the royal scribe, who sits at a carpeted table in the left foreground, writing the king's annals, the record that plays a crucial role later in the Esther story. To his left, a figure gestures towards Esther while looking directly out at us. Such rhetorical language, again drawn from the theater, suggests the way works of art featuring the figure of Esther would have continued to induce thoughtful responses in viewers, echoing the original character and ritual celebratory intention of the Esther scroll and the Purim story. It would be nice, of course, if everything were as celebratory or playful in mood and character. But the Hebrew Bible on the whole wades as much or more into the complexities of human existence. And artists on the whole were inclined to pursue somber themes as much or more than happy ones. Well, there is no more somber, anguished a character in the Hebrew Bible than Jeremiah, the prophet whose artistic legacy will be the focus of our next and the final episode in this series. But even, or perhaps especially with Jeremiah, as we'll see, the dark clouds of his words and the intimate way he expresses them evoked deeply personal responses in artists and patrons, inspiring them to conceive a new figural language. Looking forward to seeing you then.